This is our second session. If we can, if I can remember, if you can either. But I think where we left off is where we might as well pick up. I couldn't really recall having anything that I needed to go back. Oh, actually, one thing. I take it back. I don't know if I should have brought this up maybe before we started off tape, but you mentioned in your moving to the States to be with your mom that you traveled alone, and you were about 10 years old, I think, 11.
Mm-hmm, 10.
And you called it the trip bizarre. And then you said you'd get back to it, and I didn't pick up on it, and don't know if it now is something that you just said it was a weird, experience and a weird.
Well, I can't remember exactly what I said, but there's nothing sort of deep or pathological there.
It's, no, it wasn't the case. So, anything, though. I was
no, it was. I was. I guess by yeah.
I was well, held, you know, kidnapped and held under the storage thing of the boat. I think it was by ship. I don't know why. I think.
Oh yeah, right.
It was plane, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Why?
Yeah, Jack London and I sailed across backwards through time, got scurvy. No, I mean, I was dropped off by my father at Haneda at the airport in Tokyo, and it was the first time that had happened, and transferred planes in San Francisco, and it was bizarre because there was a huge storm, and it was very... windy and rainy, and you know, just what happened to Caesar. So, it was a very violent storm, and so to travel in that and to be by myself was frightening.
That's, I guess, other than being, that's not too pathological, and number one, but number two, that's what I was, I guess, curious about was that, was it weird? Also, I was wondering if you had meant it was weird because, of course, maybe it was, you know, for any 10-year-old to kind of, you know, have to go through something like that, right? I mean, your parents had split up. And,
mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if that was had colored what you thought, you know, as a 10-year-old, you thought was a pretty odd trip.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. That's
nothing more than what you expected.
Shouldn't have asked that one. We kind of left off somewhere, we did talk an awful lot about your, you know, your more extended family, and I think that's where we ended up. But we had kind of left you somewhere in L.A., kind of adjusting to things. But we, I guess we'd say somewhere in high school, and we were just talking more about your, I don't know how to phrase it. But
well, we skipped the part where I went... 3-for-4 in the Little League All-Star game.
Oh, we did skip that part. Okay, we better not.
High school, eh?
Well, so, not unless you want to go back.
No. That's why they call it Little League.
You can tell who never went into Little League because I never ask anybody about this.
I still have my pin.
Is that something you started in Japan?
Playing baseball?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah.
It's also the national pastime there.
Yeah, yeah. Used to go to Tokyo Giants games.
And so you, as soon as you could, you were old enough to play, you did. Do you want to answer that?
Excuse me.
Yeah. Okay, so we're back. And, yeah, I mean, if you're willing, I'd like to, if you started playing Little League. And
talk about baseball?
Yeah, if you really got into it and enjoyed sure did, a lot,
yeah.
Played an awful lot of it.
Yeah.
All the way through high school, I guess. I get the same.
No. I stopped after Little League. But, yeah, I mean, it was a big part of my childhood, playing with my father, playing catch in Japan, going to games. I had this experience when I was little that in Japan you're not supposed to be left-handed. I'm left-handed. So, you know, I didn't consider myself Japanese to the point where that was a stigma, but culturally it was weird. And the Tokyo Giants have this, or had this incredible hitter, Sada Haruo, and he was left-handed. And so...
God, even I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's a national hero. And I guess, you know, in retrospect, he was someone who said, who sort of proved to me that being left-handed was okay in an odd way. And I don't know, baseball, God, I've got lots of...
baseball stories?
Baseball stories, you know, playing catch in the morning and catching the ball with my hand instead of my glove and crying and stuff like that.
Oh, by accident? No,
yeah,
no,
just by
accident. Okay.
No.
How and, tough you were or something.
Oh, no.
And, sure, no, I mean...
You know, being pitching in Little League and winning the championship, blah, blah, blah.
And this is both in the States and in Japan, or we know...
Well, no, I didn't play organized... In an organized league in Japan.
Oh, okay, that was just out in the backyard.
Just here, yeah.
The games and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, we would have...
I would have thought they would have had some sort of little league even in Japan. I mean, I'm sure they must.
Yeah, I don't really know, to tell you the truth. They must, but I didn't participate. In fact, they might not, because Japanese are so serious about being studious when you're in secondary school.
Right. You probably don't have that.
But they must get their baseball player somewhere, you know. In high school, it's a really big thing. It's the high school baseball championships are televised. They're sort of the equivalent of the Final Four here in basketball, you know, in national TV coverage.
Yeah. I was in North Carolina last week before, so there was quite a bit of basketball going on.
Oh, God, yeah.
Sort of thing. You didn't play it in high school, though. It wasn't, you know, you didn't have a varsity, you weren't on the varsity team and get a letter and all that sort of thing, or were too late for that really being a...
Well, my high school sports were gymnastics, volleyball. I was on the team, when I was a senior, the team I was on took fourth in the nationals in volleyball, and mountaineering. Rock climbing.
Yeah, but that was like a varsity sport.
No. Yeah, yeah.
A club type activity.
No, not at all. Just in an odd thing, I ended up teaching backpacking. I was in a program within the LA City Schools, which was. A new model for high school education, and it doesn't exist anymore. But what happened is independent program school, IPS. I think that's what IPS stood for.
Sounds pretty good.
And the idea was that people could take classes for less than an hour a day. That is, courses would meet with the frequency of college courses. And that would free up time for students to do independent projects. the way it was organized, I was at University High School in West LA. Five faculty taught all the courses. And, of course, California has a physical education requirement. So part of the physical education things that we did were ad hoc. And so when I was a senior, I ended up teaching basic mountaineering as a PE part of this program. And anyway, the school was... I thought it was really great. The faculty involved were fantastic.
And this was open to anybody at Uni High or just...
It was, but because there were only five faculty, they wanted to keep the student-faculty ratio the same as in the regular classes. And so you had to get into it by lot. And there were many more people that wanted to get into it than could be accommodated by the number of faculty involved. And it was also just a pilot program.
So you just got lucky.
Got lucky.
By the lottery.
Exactly. I mean, I was pretty bored in the normal.
And this started in 9th grade, 10th grade?
Started in 11th.
Okay. So I had... really new stuff or beginning stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I had been in the regular 10th grade and, you know, was really ready for something else.
It actually sounds amazingly similar to something I was in for
oh, really?
2 years called school within a school where there were very little class time. And they just suspended it on my senior year because they just couldn't, the rest of the schools couldn't seem to deal with the fact that there might be people allowed to wander the halls when in between was just really rather a dismal failure from that point of view, but I thought it was great.
Yeah.
We designed our own English classes, you know, and read what we wanted to, sort of thing.
Yeah.
The administration just seemed to find that really difficult. So when they found out we were reading, like, Faulkner, you know, his more trashy novels, they just really, you know, upset with the English teacher and whatnot. So enough of my own.
Well, for us, it was Vonnegut.
Pretty similar time period. I'm just, that's curious. Not to talk about myself endlessly or anything like that.
Oh, this was great. I mean, I ended up my senior year working at the L.A. County Museum of Natural History in a dig at the La Brea Tar Pits.
Really? Yeah.
So I started out sorting microfossils mm-hmm. and finding out really what insects were living and got trapped in the tar, mm-hmm. you know, 30,000 years ago, whatever. And ended up my work on the project. I was a volunteer. I wasn't getting paid, but ended up actually excavating working in the excavation of the pit. They had this pit in the tar that they were sort of digging down in with grids and everything marked. So I would be in there chipping the tar away from, you know, saber-toothed tiger mm-hmm. bones or sloth bones or whatever it was, you know.
And you just fell into that, you know, sorry, no pun intended. You fell into that, as a, you know, you heard about it from teachers at school. This was just you'd always go on to the museum, or
I think I can't remember how I heard about this specific dig.
But you turned it into school kind of credit too. I mean, this was a
yeah.
And you did that on your
own. Well, that was the most structured part of the independent thing I did. I also took math at UCLA, as in the time that I wasn't in high school.
So you still were at school like the whole typical school day?
No. That was the whole point, is that you could be anywhere. You didn't even have to be on campus, right? And the courses met 2 or 3 days a week. The structured courses met 2 or 3 days a week. And that left the rest of the time to do something else. And, you know, people built, some people, like one person built a Baja Racer automobile.
This was not like, even though it was by lottery, it wasn't by students who were tracked into special classes or dance classes.
No.
Somebody who was going to end up going the vocational route, obviously, or had been in a vocational kind of track.
Well, some people were. I mean, the point of the population in the program was that it shouldn't be selected. Okay. The idea was to see if it could work as a different model for the general student population in this school. I mean, some people did just, you know, essentially go to the beach and didn't get that much done.
It's kind of like life, you know.
Yeah, like some people go to the beach. Yeah.
You also said, you know, it stopped. I mean, you were aware that it didn't continue, or that it didn't move from like pilot status to being instituted all over the LA.
Yeah.
Did you follow it later, or you just?
Not in detail. Why did it stop? I don't know. I mean, I imagine. Well, I really don't know.
Some sort of alumni, or mentor.
I had one particular person. He was the person that sort of got me interested in anthropology, mm-hmm. really, and also, I think from that, I mean, that's what attracted me to the dig at the Museum of Natural History. The guy's name was Milt Annisman. He's now retired. He was a teacher at uni, science teacher. He taught an anthro course. I mean, how many high schools have an anthro course? I mean, he made up this anthro course for this program, basically. Mm-hmm. He taught biology as well. And really brought the whole field alive in terms of intellectual conflicts. He would present several sides and present ideas as they developed rather than just as truth.
You weren't getting that, let's say, even in a history class or a, what they might call a civics
situation. Sure, you see, I mean, you see that in history for sure. I mean, that's maybe the major part of the content of history. But the thing that Annisman added to Anthro was this technical, the technical content of the field, essentially physical Anthro. Mm-hmm. That was what the course was. It wasn't cultural. It was physical anthropology. So you had the discoveries of bones, basically, mm-hmm. and fossils. So there was some paleontology in there, and then human evolution. So, God, can you imagine teaching human evolution at a sophisticated level in public schools now? I mean, you'd get a lot of political heat for it in some communities.
Yeah, bothering really anymore. But you figure that biologicals still must be the dissect the frog sort of.
Oh, I did that too.
Situation. No, I'm trying to remember my own. They must have to address evolution in that. I mean, they have to, right? If you're dissecting an amphibian, a frog, start making connections and whatnot. But you're right. I'm sure that they soft pedaled up.
Well,
more theoretical and.
Yeah, I think after I moved, for example, to Oregon, I felt that this sort of frank discussion or description of evolutionary ideas that I had even in high school was, I realized that it was unusual in the sense that when I was in Eugene, Oregon.
This is your postdoc.
Yeah, by the
way. Right. Had you lived there earlier? Or?
In Eugene?
Yeah.
No.
Okay,
but
I'm sorry.
It turns out that, you know, Eugene is a small town in rural Oregon, mm-hmm. and there's a religious strength in that community. So the Baptists are pretty strong in Oregon, and evolution is was controversial when I was there. You know, and should it be taught in schools? And this was a political battle that was actually going on in public. Whereas when I was in high school, it was something my teacher just, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Taught and really brought to life. Yeah. So anyway, he made this experience at the Natural History Museum sort of, compelling, I think, to me. And actually, when I went to college, I was contemplating majoring in anthro. Mm-hmm. And took a number of anthropology courses in my first 2 years.
It seems, I mean, we can either talk about the math class first or talk about what I guess is kind of question I'm going to ask you. Seems to be a pretty heavy intellectual diet for a senior. I mean, even
in high school?
Yeah, I mean, a private high school kind of, a special math class at UCLA, and the fun afternoon part is spent, doing paleontology digs.
Well, I was also climbing and teaching backpacking and teaching climbing, and I did my share of going to the beach.
Okay, then you were a workaholic, or you should never go to bed, or what? I mean, whatever.
Oh, no.
Already at that age.
You know, I think what else?
Active and.
Excuse me.
Stuff like that. Okay.
Yeah, so we were talking about what are some of the activities in high school that didn't have anything to do with, an intellectual environment. And I'd say, exploring the Sierras was something I did a lot. Getting out in the mountains.
I guess I would argue, though, that if you were teaching it and stuff, it's not just kind of like fun. I mean,
it was
an intellectual experience as well as a physical.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Again, do you know how you got interested in? I mean, what was the just a friend, your family who went hiking with you the first time?
Oh no, it was my half brother up here in Walnut Creek when I was 14. Took me up to the series for the first time. Wow. And I really got hooked. I started climbing in high school. Again, a friend took me out to a place in the San Fernando Valley.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't... That's the Angeles Crest National Forest?
No, it's a place called Stony Point in Chatsworth. And I didn't really have a good time, but my mother was so horrified by the whole thing. I did it again as a
surefire way to horrify your mom.
Yeah, exactly. A way to rebel, you know. And then I started enjoying it a lot. Went to places I went a lot were Talkeets Rock and Idlewild in Southern California. And then my friend Tim and I did some climbs in the Sierras, technical things.
Mm-hmm. And you do this every year, sort of, or you, a lot of your vacation?
Well, a lot less technical things now, actually. I pretty much stopped technical climbing in graduate school. But, you know, when I was in high school, for example, I climbed the east face of Whitney, which is a couple thousand foot wall that you hike into. And, you know, it was an incredible day, incredible climb, really fun.
You did it in a day, huh? I guess you have to do it until you can't.
Well, we started early in the morning and got to the top. It was a July 4th weekend, and when we signed the register, there were a couple hundred other people that had signed the register that day, but we didn't see anybody because we were on the technical side, on the steep side, and we sort of popped up over the top, and there was a crowd up there, and people had no idea where we'd come from. It was really a weird thing, and then we started coiling the ropes, and it kind of dawned on people.
Wow.
And it was really neat. Mm-hmm. It's a neat thing because that summit, you actually, you finish the most difficult things a little bit farther down, but the last move onto the summit from the east face is, you just pull yourself up onto it. It's not a walk. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you're there. So it was really exciting.
So you've done it more than once then? I guess I get the impression. Or did you just really move
on
that
Whitney?
One? Yeah.
I've done that climb once.
Just once?
Yeah.
It sounds the way you're describing it, though, is maybe it's happened more than, you know, once.
Oh, no.
It's made that much of an impression. When you speak of it as kind of a, you know, well, you do this, when you do that, and so more familiarity with it or something than just the one. But I guess something like that, perhaps you only need the one experience. And you're pretty familiar with it, right? Why do it again? It was there, you did it. Okay, maybe saying you were kind of intellectual or even using the word workaholic before, you know, you really can be because you're a teenager. You just seem incredibly, I don't know, active.
Well, I don't know. I did my homework and I played chess, but,
you know. Yeah. And,
what can I say?
I guess maybe that was just what other people around you were doing. I mean, this is the kind of, you mentioned one friend so far, Tim, but I guess I'm trying to see if we can't talk more about just a milieu in which you would be doing all these different things. I even think you said something about it really wasn't that, you know, though maybe you said outside of the intellectual development. Mm-hmm. But also that maybe you said I wasn't really in an intellectual atmosphere or something like that, but I don't know if I misunderstood you or...
Well, I guess my friends were thoughtful people. Mm-hmm. My best friend, his name was John Bennett. He went on in college to study mathematics, for example. And I felt like we talked about, you know, serious things. And
like mathematics, perhaps?
Well, no, we didn't talk about mathematics, but... things about, you know, growing up, basically.
Mm-hmm. You said something in the first tip, too, about just always, again, using, I think you qualified very heavily the word outsider and didn't mean to imply anything about being forced to be an outsider or anything, but just always having that sense of maybe looking in on something because, one, you really had grown up in a different culture, mm-hmm. and you had this mm-hmm. whole other experience, and you just don't shed it and that sort of thing. But also, you used the word thoughtful. Now your friends were thoughtful. That perhaps that was a smaller number of people, or a smaller group of, or a smaller percentage of the high school population. That sort of thing. But again, well, you didn't mean it in an elitist way, I don't think, or in a way that you were pointed out as on the outside, but just a sense sometimes of.
I think that in my first year of high school, just in the regular high school curriculum at uni, most of my friends were sort of considered nerds, as every high school has that group of people. And I found that very dissatisfying, and I think that was one of the reasons that I really loved this alternative program, is that there were different sorts of people. People were trying to formulate important projects, projects that were important to them at an early age, identify things that they wanted to do with their time, and then do them.
Yeah.
And you know, that process is exciting, and you see it in the people around you. The people were sort of more diverse than the people I had sort of hung out with before. They were more fun. So I really liked it. And the program itself, of course, was innovative, so it was always under threat. It was outside the standard curriculum, and so we always had a sense that it could be canceled or stopped, and it eventually was, yeah. And we had to, you know, it was a sense of having to prove yourself. And I would say UC Santa Cruz, where I went to college, had the same sort of mission of being outside the standard educational paradigm and being criticized just for that reason and being always under threat that it would be converted to a standard university without colleges, with grades, with fewer independent projects that faculty and students arranged, you know, basically a standard university.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back on. Yeah, there was really, I guess, just kind of following this through, clearly this was a real way of escaping what I guess you thought were a lot of silly or artificial constraints. For instance, you mentioned this identity, you know, there really was, it almost seems like a lot of pressure to belong to certain groups, or these groups were very clearly defined among the student population. There were the nerds, there were the whatevers and the whatevers. There was no mixing of the, you know, if you were this kind of a person, you were this kind of a person. Was that really a strong thing at the rest of the high school, or just something that bothered you that really was a fluid sort of? And do you know what I mean?
I guess I don't really remember, you know, objectively what it was like.
I mean, I'm asking you more so that you felt this. I mean, this is something that really bugged you, so that this program that came along when you were a junior was a real godsend, or when you came along, you just kind of were like, oh, wow, great, let's do this.
Well, I didn't know what it was going to be like. It didn't exist. I started into it in the first year, so I didn't know that it would be such a positive thing. But in terms of, you know, why I would want to do it, yeah, I mean, certainly there were personal reasons.
You said something about being bored too.
Well, yeah, and I was more of a shy person. I'm still a shy person, but I was more of a shy person then. And whether social groups were fluid or not, they weren't for me.
They weren't for you, period. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm just not following you, but that way.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that I didn't have any friends, but I would say that my feeling about 10th grade is that it was too intellectual. You know, it was missing exactly those things you were asking about. You know, and sort of by the time I got to be a senior, I don't know, I got a C in chemistry, for example. I mean, I'm a chemist, but it just, I didn't care about high school chemistry for some reason, and so I didn't do well, I didn't study it, I was doing other things.
And it didn't matter,
yeah. Right. So I didn't end up with a 4 point in high school, you know, I'm going to, whoa!
But it sounds like maybe this program was kind of like, that made it all the more, I mean, not that you were sitting around worrying about it previous to that, but it was clear to you that that wasn't the goal of what you were doing, right, in this program. I mean, in this independent school program, you weren't there to get straight A's so that you could, you know, you were there to have, to develop some skills or learn some interesting things.
And to learn things, yeah, yeah. I mean, I did virtually get straight A's in high school. But you can probably look that up. You know?
That's understood for all of you. All the people I interviewed for the Pew, we all got straight A's, unless you say otherwise. Anyway, I just wanted to...
On the tape, laughter.
Laughter, right? It goes in brackets. I guess one last... thing, actually, I'll ask this too. Again, I'm not trying, this is not, oh, let's kind of do a psychological profile of it. You said also as a child, you mentioned the example of having to go to the Japanese school when you were, and you said you were very shy, and of course that was exacerbated by the fact that you were the only non-Japanese child in this classroom, and you mentioned that you're shy in high school, and you said, I'm a shy person. I guess that's, and these are first impressions, that's not what I would say you are. I might say, oh, you seem kind of quiet, or because you do speak quietly, or you may be a little reserved, but I guess shy is not what I... When someone asks you, I mean, was this something everybody said, oh, you're shy, Tom, or you just always felt...
No, I always felt shy. I still feel shy. Not very outgoing. In some ways, it helps a lot to be shy if you are going to spend hours and hours and hours in a lab working by yourself late at night. I mean... You don't miss it, exactly.
What's going on, right?
Right. I mean, if you can't be by yourself, you can't do biology or biochemistry. I mean, it's just... if you're sort of addicted to constantly talking with people, in a way.
I do it for a living.
Well, it's funny. Then the things that are necessary to succeed change as you go through, your career. In the beginning, you have to be able to be motivated to go get the results, and as it goes along, you have to sell the results a lot more heavily. So you do end up.
I was going to say, shyness doesn't seem to be a quality that's going to be prized or that you're going to hang on to in a situation like this. Obviously, you aren't required to be photogenic and, always have your hair the right way and go to a lot of parties to be a good biologist and to be in a milieu in which you can communicate your ideas and attract good, and keep the process going.
Yeah.
But you certainly need to have some... aggressive qualities or social that would get you
sure.
out there. So.
Sure. I find that to be a hard part of what I do now. You know, I don't enjoy giving lectures, for example. I mean, I give a lot of lectures and I try to be entertaining and, thoughtful. But I'm always nervous
butterflies in the stomach, kind of nervous before talk, or just
not that bad.
Uncomfortable period.
I used to get butterflies in the stomach, but yeah, just sort of generally uncomfortable until the
thing is over. This is one of the downsides and responsibilities of doing what you do, and you'll do it. But you're certainly okay. And you mean when you lectures and whatnot? You mean invited kind of?
Oh yeah.
Things at
yeah.
conferences, not about lecturing. Let's say part of a class, conducting part of a class here or something like that.
Well, even that, I mean, I want to do it well, being invited to give lectures at meetings or at universities or wherever is good, because it's a measure of recognition. Okay. Giving the lecture itself can be a lot of fun, especially if it's going well and you know the audience is there and you're there and there's this thing going on and you know that they're going to appreciate it. That's fun. And then when they appreciate it, that's fun. And then you, if you get ideas talking to people, that's, you know, something I like to do. What I don't like to do is get ready. And now I find that now I can do it because I sort of know how to do it. But when I first started doing it, it was difficult because I didn't have a sense that what I was doing would actually produce a product that would be something I would like.
Or that's something that they would all like too, I mean, or that you, you know,
yeah.
That
yeah.
The selling points are now maybe they're more clear in your mind, and you know that because of, you know, your wider experience in the field or whatever.
No, it's more an issue of how to tell a story that is going to make people think. And I wasn't very good at that, 5 years ago or 7 years ago. When I was looking for my first faculty position, I didn't give good job seminars, for example. Yeah, it was difficult.
I mean, people said to you that wasn't very good, or you just felt they weren't good?
I felt that they weren't very good.
I guess we can move on to you going to Santa Cruz. I mean, I think that, again, hadn't been open that long, perhaps what, a decade, maybe just under a decade when you started going there.
No, 4 years.
So you went and started undergrad in 69?
72.
Oh, I thought it opened 65, but
Maybe you're right, I thought it was 68, but it was, from college to college, it differed when each one opened up.
I just want to ask about this mathematics thing. I guess you were taking undergraduate classes at UCLA as a high school student, or involved in some sort of special program to encourage?
Oh, yeah. The LA City Schools had an arrangement with UCLA that selected students could take two classes a quarter. And I just took one, and it was just calculus. It wasn't anything fancy.
Okay, you just pick calculus because it was one of the ones that looked interesting?
Well, no, I like math, and it was the next thing to do in math, and why not take it at UCLA?
And so it didn't have much, it had really little effect on your outlook, or maybe
mathematics? Actually, I thought I might major in mathematics when I went to Santa Cruz, and I started taking a math course my first quarter there, and I could not understand the professor. His German accent was so thick, I couldn't understand it, and I just gave up. I mean, I just couldn't, for the life of me, I couldn't understand what he was saying in the lectures.
This was like another calculus type class?
I can't remember what it was, number theory or something.
So you just bagged the whole thing, other things became more interesting.
Other things became more interesting, that was the key.
I mean, I think we have a good explanation already on tape, as well as, I mean, people could infer it of why you went to UC Santa Cruz instead of, let's say, Princeton or UCLA or something like that. It's a non-traditional kind of program.
Well, I mean, I specifically visited the places I was considering. So MIT, so that'll give you a sense of how I thought about myself, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to go to MIT. So I went to MIT. My father took me around all these places. So the three places I was considering were MIT, Stanford, Santa Cruz. MIT, yeah, it was fine, but at the time, it looked like there was a lot of stone. And when we took off from Logan Airport leaving, I couldn't see any mountains, so bagged that. And
the Berkshires.
Stanford was fine, and so that was the second place I visited, and it was sort of my first choice after I visited there. But what actually happened is my father had a friend at Stanford, and we borrowed his car and drove to Santa Cruz just for an afternoon and walked around. And I met people there that were just very interesting. Rick Davern ended up being my... Davern. Ended up being a professor for Biology 1. And I met him in his lab just walking through one of the buildings. And he was just an interesting person. And I felt like this could be a very stimulating environment.
And what did your dad think about that? I mean, there must have been some kind of stark contrast at some point between like walking around campus at MIT and walking around campus at UCSC or something. That
yeah,
and certainly the reputation of the one over the other, just because the other one was new. Never mind, perhaps that maybe it quite hadn't gotten the reputation that it had. Let's say when I was thinking of applying there, as kind of a what I would call a stoner school or whatever, you know, where you didn't really have to do anything to get through.
Well, that was true, but half the entering class had 4-point high school grade point averages. And
it had attracted some pretty interesting faculty all across the board.
Yeah, and they were really committed to working with students individually, much more so than now. They got exhausted while I was there. But it's an interesting place. Oh, my God. My father, you have to understand, he was very supportive. He said, go anywhere you want to go, and I'll take you around to all the places. And, you know, he never graduated from college. He's been a maverick. He did what he thought was important. And so he was, I felt, genuinely supportive, and I guess I still feel that, you know. He was not judgmental. And if he was, he managed to conceal it. Okay? Yeah, exactly. My mother, on the other hand, when I made my decision to go to Santa Cruz, I had picked her up at work. She works at UCLA. And we were driving down Sunset Boulevard, and I said, Mom, I've decided to go to Santa Cruz. Well, you have to... This is sort of a microcosm, maybe, of my relationship with my mother. But first of all, I had been using the car that day. And so I picked her up in front of her office, but she was nervous when I was driving. So she always drove, even though she was like one of the worst drivers in the world. I mean, talk about her being nervous when I drove. My God. Anyway, so she's driving down Sunset Boulevard. It's a little after 5 o'clock, so there's traffic, right? And I said, Mom, I decided to go to Santa Cruz. And she's trying to keep her eye on the road and just cry hysterically at the same time. So she really was upset, and she thought I was going to ruin my life and waste my life, and why am I going there, and da-da-da-da-da. So she, in fact, dropped me off in Santa Cruz and didn't visit till I graduated. So it was...
she also had a pretty non-conventional... I mean, UCLA was conventional, I suppose, when she was an undergraduate there, in some sense, but she had a pretty non-conventional view of the world, too, and I'm just kind of curious about that. But she had also, you mentioned, I think, on tape, purposely moved to the apartment that you moved into when you got to the States because of the school.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There was no, that was the top, it didn't matter price, cost, I mean, where she wanted to be, close to family or not close to family in the area, right? It was just to put you in that school, so.
This well, it was like a major consideration, yeah. So, you know, I guess she was, I mean, she didn't say this, but, you know, I guess she was worried that I was, wasting a really good opportunity.
It's true love on the other side.